Good morning, members. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I'd like to call the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. A couple of things here real quick, some housekeeping. I've got two sets of minutes here, one from January 18th and one from the 19th. Representative Backer, would you move the minutes for us, please?
I would so move.
Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Minutes are adopted. I want to say thank you to Representative Eklund. He's supplied some coffee, so if you have some comments, good or bad, on the coffee, they can be directed towards Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's for your information, that's a Rainy Lake blend coffee for the greatest lake in the state of Minnesota, and it's I bought it at Coffee Landing in International Falls.
And members, we're not going to start a discussion here today on the greatest lake in the land, okay? Members, I want to say thank you to Mr. Cornicelli and Dr. Paul Anderson for being here today to take us through a very timely topic and a very important topic on chronic wasting disease and what's going on. I should mention, too, we do have a quorum, so we can get started, obviously. But we've got this other little bill going around right now, Senate File 1, I believe it is. Yeah. So I've got some other obligations today that I won't be here, so I'll be turning the gavel over to my very capable vice chair, Chair Heintzman. So with that, I'll call any comments or questions first before we get started? Members? Yes, Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, so tomorrow is the subcommittee?
Yes, tomorrow is the subcommittee. They'll be meeting and they'll be going through an overview with forestry from Forest Bow, which I've always find ironic. Forest Bow is in charge of forestry. I like that. And then Thursday we will be back here again. This committee will be meeting, and we're going through that 404 assumption. And then also we have one other thing on the agenda, and I can't recall right off the top of my head what that is. Yeah, I need more coffee so I can straighten out. Mr. Cornicelli, would you come down, please? Identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and you got 3 minutes. No, I'm kidding.
Mr. Chair, I'm from New York. I can do it in one and a half.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, Lou Cornicelli, Department of Natural Resources. I'm the Wildlife Research Manager for the department, and I oversee all the wildlife research activities for DNR. So I'm here to talk about chronic wasting disease. So if you want me to get started.
Proceed.
Presentation's a little long. I'm not going to touch on everything in it. I mean, I wanted to get a lot of it in front of you just so you have the information, but I'm going to kind of breeze through much of the beginning and talk about our response since learning that we have CWD in the last 60 days. So first off, before we get started, we do think we're on the front end of this infection. There's a couple of things that give us that indication. We have a lot of mature bucks. The deer that we're finding, and I'll get into it, are in the one local area. We've taken a lot of samples. So we really do think that that we caught this early. All six deer that I'm going to talk about have shown no clinical signs, according to the hunter, so they may have been recently infected in the last year or so. So I do think we're not comparable to states like Wisconsin and others where the disease is well established. We do think we caught it pretty early in the process. So if that's the case, our goal is to eliminate the disease. If we can do it right away and do it aggressively, I think we can do that. It kind of hinges on our ability to lower risk and lower the chance of transmission from deer to deer. One thing that comes up, and I wanted to put it in big capital letters, is that we're not eradicating deer. We hear that all the time. The DNR is going to kill every deer. You know, we couldn't do it if we wanted to. It's not feasible. It's not practical. It's not even. It's just stuff that comes up that just isn't right. We do hope. We've dealt with this a couple times before. Once with bovine tuberculosis in the northwest and in the southeast near Pine Island with CWD, where we had an aggressive response, and we've been able to, in our estimation, either eliminate the disease or reduce prevalence to a degree where it can't be detected. So we've actually been through this a couple different times, and we're hoping to have the same outcome. So chronic wasting disease is a progressive neurological disease. Caused by a prion, relates to scrapie in sheep or bovine spongiform encephalopathy in cattle. That's a mouthful. That's why they call it mad cow, I think. This picture here is actually our Pine Island positive. The hunter who killed it actually got it on his trail camera a couple days before he killed it. So if you look at this deer, it has clinical symptoms. See how thin it is? So this is kind of the end of the infection in the case of this animal. So this was actually the only wild positive deer prior to the southeast that was found in this state. There does seem to be a significant species barrier with humans and cattle. Neurological signs, it's direct contact with saliva, feces, and urine. Incubation period is long, year and a half to 3 years, which is why you see when we talk about wanting to go 3 years in a row of no negatives, that's because of the long incubation period of the disease. So we want it. Testing 1 year doesn't really help. It has to be out 3 years. Infected animals do start shedding these prions soon after they're exposed. Across the U.S., there's more and more CWD infections described every year. Most recently, I think there's a couple of new areas in a couple of states. I think Missouri and Nebraska. There's been 6 game farms, I think, in the last month. Two in Minnesota, one in Iowa, one in Michigan, one in Pennsylvania, and one in Texas. So there's been a kind of a rash of game farms, as well as a few more wild positives in addition to us. We hear oftentimes that everything's okay. You know, we haven't seen these big declines in deer in Wisconsin. We haven't seen much in 40 years in Colorado and Wyoming, which isn't technically correct. But things really aren't okay. The disease is 100% fatal, so animals that are infected do predispose themselves to mortality rates that are higher than healthy deer. That makes sense. They have something wrong with their brain. Even if they're not clinically symptomatic, there's something going on that predisposes them to higher natural mortality. And the disease is 100% fatal, so if it doesn't die from some other method, the lifespan of this animal, the individual's animals are decreased. We know from other research that bucks, mature males, are 3 times more likely to have the disease. That's based on just their biology. Yearling males can really be described as a CWD delivery system. So they get infected someplace else, or they are infected somewhere else, and their biology is such that they immigrate out from where they were born, and they tend to set up home ranges. They can set up home ranges as long distances from where they were born, so they can carry that prion great distances if given that opportunity. We do know, and Wisconsin's a perfect example of this, is that the percentage of deer increases annually, and the geographic spread radiates out annually as well. So it just doesn't sit there at 1% for the rest of time. There's been a recent paper in Wyoming that shows the disease is impacting white-tailed deer populations in eastern Wyoming. It's just taken a long time to be able to have enough data to draw that conclusion. Wisconsin is seeing these pretty dramatic increases in prevalence in Iowa and Dane County, and they've not yet seen population-level impacts, but they certainly will in the future. I mean, I think that's their future. Wisconsin calls them droolers and shakers, and they're seeing more and more of those every year. So a brief rundown of our surveillance. We've not been sitting on our heels waiting for this. We've done about 50,000 deer since 2002, prompted principally by the discovery of an elk farm in Aiken County back in 2002, and also the Wisconsin CWD outbreak also in 2002. That's what kicked off our statewide surveillance. And this map shows what we did, from 2002 to 2004. In those 3 years, we did 28,000 samples. And since 2002, we've actually done about 50,000 CWD samples in Minnesota. So we've done lots and lots of surveillance. But we can't afford to do this every year, everywhere. It's very expensive. So we kind of look at CWD response as an element of risk. So where does risk change? Risk changes when a new infection or an expanding infection is found in Iowa or Wisconsin. Risk changes when it's found in a game farm. So we have in our surveillance plan, we look at doing surveillance when our risk changes, just simply because doing a statewide sweep in 1 year would likely cost $1.5 million, $2 million to do it right. So we look at things as how do we best use our limited resources to evaluate where the disease may be based on those risk factors.
Just a second.
Yes, sir.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. On this, recently the DNR has implemented the call-in registration for when you take an animal. If you're concerned about an area for an outbreak, would that be that portion of the state or that area be eliminated? So we'd have to go back into the registration stations, because I remember in the past when we'd register the deer, they'd take the sample right there.
Mr. Quinicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, that's correct. In 2010, we implemented the phone and internet registration as part of our electronic registration system. And I was actually part of that. It's when I had the big game program. And it's probably one of the few things that I was part of that people actually called just to say thanks. But it is very popular. But what we do, when we do voluntary surveillance, when we're talking about disease detection, we do turn off the phone and internet registration and force people to go to the stores, and we turn it off until we reach our surveillance quotas. Typically, that's the first 3 days of the firearm season. So the e-registration will be on right up until the gun season starts. We'll shut it off, then we'll turn it back on. And that's what we actually did in the southeast when we were looking for CWD this year. So we do temporarily turn it off just in the areas that we're doing surveillance.
Representative Eklund, follow-up.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Cornicelli, you mentioned that there's a burst of detections with game farms recently. And is there any evidence of deer moving between those particular farms or people moving between those farms or a product moving between those farms? If you're having multiple outbreaks in a very short period of time.
Mr. Cornfield.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I'll have to defer to Dr. Anderson with the board on the farm survey activities. It's outside my purview. We haven't been working with the trace-ins, trace-outs. We've been handling the wild deer response. So I think Dr. Anderson's here, and we'll speak to that in a bit.
Representative Svezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. You talked a little bit just in an earlier slide about, it's 100% fatal. My guess is that probably a fair amount would get predation, once they get to a certain point during the disease. I mean, have you done any studies on what percentage of the affected population actually makes it to kind of a natural death standpoint before they would be, taken by a timber wolf or a coyote or something like that?
Mr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have in Minnesota done some long-term research on deer survival, specifically in the forest where wolves and bears are prevalent. The deer live, white-tailed deer females live an amazingly long time. They'll actually make it out 14, 15, 16 years, and it's if they're not killed by some other method, but when it's usually winter that gets them. And we have a severe winter, and that's kind of what gets them. Wolf mortality, at the time that study was done in the mid-90s to the early 90s to the mid-2000s, wolf mortality obviously is a piece of the puzzle, but there's also hunter-harvested mortality, which is the number one source of deer mortality in the state, and also winter in the forest. And if we're thinking about in the southeast, you have coyotes are the largest predator, and they're pretty much on fawns and occasionally adults, but not usually. A deer that doesn't get harvested can live a pretty long time, and they'll actually have fawns all the way up to their last year or two. But we haven't done any specific studies related to disease ecology and deer survival yet, mainly because we haven't faced this disease really over the long term. Wisconsin's done a lot of that.
Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question on, I didn't hear you mention motorized by victims, both humans and deer. What element of that does that play in just the natural population of the deer? Obviously, at least some areas, my area, a few miles down the road, is frequent to see two and three deer dead along the road every month, hit by cars. So obviously that's an element too. Is that a major element? Certainly a human issue in some areas.
Mr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewitt, deer vehicle collisions in general, there's been some work that's shown that deer that are positive for the disease are more likely to get hit by cars. So, but in general, deer vehicle collisions are, a component that we live with. Obviously, there's a higher percentage of deer in the metro hit by cars than there are outstate. And And then the timing also varies. You know, they get hit a lot in the fall when they're breeding. They get hit a lot in the winter. A lot of times people are feeding deer, and those deer are getting creamed on the road as they go to somebody's feeder. So, vehicle mortality is sort of accounted for when we look at population size. But from the disease perspective, yes, they do that. They would be a suspect deer if they get hit by a car. And we do, as part of our response here, we do sample vehicle-killed deer as part of our surveillance program.
Representative Lewitt.
Thank you. And you mentioned the deer feeding, and obviously, could you provide a little more detail on the potential issues that causes if you do have an affected animal within the bunch?
Mr. Quintastella.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewitt, I've got a slide in here, but I'll touch on it briefly. As I noted, the principal way this disease is transmitted is from direct contact. So banning recreational feeding is one of the two important things we can do. Think about if one person has a cold and everybody eats out of the same cereal bowl, and likely everybody's going to get sick. But if everybody eats out of their own cereal bowl, just a couple people might get sick. So the basic premise is the same. When you reduce that unnatural nose-to-nose contact, you reduce the opportunity for spread from infected to healthy animals. The premise isn't really any different, and you're well aware of bovine tuberculosis in the Northwest, and it's the same basic function. The prion or bacteria in the case of TB is shed orally, so when we reduce that opportunity for a deer, obviously we can't ban natural nose-to-nose contact, but we can certainly ban human-induced.
Representative Lewick, you might be interested. There's an article in the Great Falls Tribune that goes through quite a number of other details on how it could be transmitted, and it's amazing. Mr. Cornicelli, please continue.
Yeah, very good. So in the Southeast, we've been doing a lot of surveillance in 2002, about 13,000 samples collected. Part of it was as a function of our Pine Island response with the positive deer and the positive elk farm. And in 2014, the disease was found for the first time in northeastern Iowa. So we actually did surveillance in the southeastern part of the state just 2 years ago and collected 411 samples from Fillmore and Houston counties and did not find the disease. So we've been doing lots and lots of active surveillance in the southeast, again, based on risk. Pine Island, just briefly, we responded the same way we're responding now, harvesting deer through landowner shooting permits and also more aggressive hunting seasons. We created a zone. We got lucky there. I've never said that we found we killed the only CWD positive deer in Pine Island. Mathematically, that doesn't make sense, but I think we were able to get on the disease fast enough that it was never able to get a stronghold in the population. So there may have been another deer out there that died from the disease that we never found, but 4,000 tested deer later through the hunting seasons found no more positive. So that aggressive response, we get criticized, well, you never found another one. But the flip side is that's a really good thing because the actions we took may have been the reason we never found another one. So we did dissolve that permit, the 602, in 2014 and went back to the regulations that we had in front of us before that. Thinking about deer harvest, when we went to an unlimited bag and a 23-day season, we added a whopping one deer per square mile to the harvest. So when folks talk about eradicating deer, we just don't do it. The goal is to increase the harvest at some level and limit that direct contact through unnatural feeding and get on that population a little bit. Right now, in the area that was 602, the harvest is pretty close to what it was before CWD. So we do lower populations in the short term with the hope of not having to do this over the long haul. So just to provide that context. So in 2016, we've been really proactive. We decided we wanted to go back and do more surveillance, basically because of Iowa and Wisconsin. So we decided to cover the entire Southeast. And we also wanted to revisit Pine Island, so we developed our sampling to oversample around the Pine Island area in case the disease was still there and we would catch it again. Overall, we found two positives initially from the samples that we took, which was just under 3,000. And then we had set up a network of taxidermists in the area, and the third positive from the hunting season actually was a taxidermy sample. So knowing that there's lots of mature bucks in the southeast, we wanted to engage the taxidermists for those deer that are going to get mounted that we wouldn't be able to cut at the check station. And we collected about, or taxidermists collected about 200 samples for us, mostly mature bucks, and they only found one positive. So that network really helped. And you can see from the red, if you can see the red, those are our first three positives. So in the short term, we established a deer population CWD management zone. We had a special hunt December 31st to January 15th. We did do a recreational feeding ban. I spelled Olmsted wrong. I apologize. I just noticed that. The weather gods smiled upon us, and we got snow, and we were able to fly an aerial survey, which I didn't think we'd be able to do. Right now, we have landowner shooting permits in the area. We have instituted mandatory testing and carcass export restrictions. You can't leave the zone with a deer carcass, an adult deer, unless it's test negative. The reason for that is we don't want somebody dumping a positive carcass in their backyard and then infecting deer in a new place. We may do a USDA sharpshooting contract, likely in our core areas. We're still under discussions about that. So the CWD management zone, we typically try and encircle a 10-square-mile area around our positives. So that's what we did based on the road network, which if you live down there or spend any time down there, the road network is not straight. So you do the best you can. And then to Representative Luke's point, we tend to ban deer feeding over a much broader area than our disease zone. And that's really done because we don't have the full extent of the infection. And it's better to be more cautious with respect to deer feeding when you really don't know everything. So our deer feeding bans tend to be a lot larger, and as Representative Lewick knows, the deer feeding ban in the bovine TB area was much, much bigger than the TB management zone, and that's to reduce transmission. So, like I said, the weather gods smiled. We were able to fly a survey. At first, we were going to fly 603, that zone I showed you. Then when the plane was in the air, or the helicopter was in the air doing the survey, we found out about our third positive, so we shifted north and completed the survey north. In total, about 24 deer per square mile. That's post-season. 11,500 deer, plus or minus a little bit. Visibility was good. Everyone loves their new helicopter, so thank you for being part of that. Visibility is great out of it. But a lot of deer. You know, all the habitat that we'd expect to see deer had deer in it. So we've got a lot of deer in the southeast, even without after the hunting season. So the special hunt, if you look at the black dot or the black dots on the map, we had a pretty decent distribution of deer taken throughout this special hunt. 16 days out of the places you would expect to see deer. All but three or four are back. We found three more positives, and lo and behold, the positives are right next to our other positives. So I think the special hunt worked from a couple of perspectives. One, it helps us define that spatial extent. We have deer killed across the unit, and we find positives, but the positives we find are right where we found them the first time. So part of this, when we talk about the special hunt, it gets kind of moved into, well, how many deer are you going to kill? We need to kill enough to be able to answer the questions as to what's our prevalence and what's our spatial distribution. And I think with this, with the landowner permits, we're going to get there and have a better sense for what we're looking at. The three deer that were killed, the first three killed were adult males. The next three killed were adult females, none of them with clinical signs. So that just speaks to, I think we got this early, or I hope we have this early. So as of January 15th, we've collected about 2,700 samples across both with our passive surveillance, or voluntary surveillance rather, in the southeast during the season, and then our active mandatory surveillance in the CWD zone. So we're covering it pretty well, and still just finding these positives in close association. So those are the numbers, almost 3,000 from voluntary walk-in, 3 from our special hunt that was focused in on the zone. 5 of the 6, if you can see the dots, are within about 3 or 4 square miles of each other. The 6th was about 5 miles north, and we're starting to wonder if that one wasn't just a disperser, a migrant just walked up there just before the deer season. So we've got active shooting permits around that deer, too, and we should be able to figure it out. So what we did with landowner shooting permits briefly is we issue permits to landowners that take deer on their land, middle of January to February 12th. We had 3 public meetings. We do walk-in permits every day. We've issued about 400 permits. We've had excellent cooperation from landowners. I read the blogs too. I I enjoy some of the names I'm called, but the reality is those are not the people who are coming into the Preston office to get a shooting permit. We've had really, really good cooperation and banding together to deal with this disease at that local level. DNR likes to blame the weather, and I'll do it in this case. The weather has been kind of crummy for the landowner shooting permits. At first it was it rained and it was foggy all week, and now they're going to get a blizzard, I think, tomorrow. So the conditions aren't great for landowners, but they're doing a little bit of harvesting. So these are the parcels that we have permission for currently. About 2,200 people have 10 acres or more, and we have just over 400 permits out. Now, obviously, not all landowners have deer on their property if they've got a lot of ag land and no cover. But we do have a pretty good spatial distribution of landowner shooting permits. And then more specifically, this might be hard to tell here, we have a lot of landowner shooting permits and also at least verbal permission to allow USDA to remove deer around our positives. So we've had really good cooperation from the landowners who have taken positive deer. So if we can't, we may enter into a contract. We're working on that agreement. Sharpshooting, important to note, we don't trespass. This isn't, you know, the black helicopter stuff. USDA needs permission on private lands, and they actually have their own set of permissions that people have to get in order for them to work on their properties. We give them permits for our stuff, and then the USDA has to get a signed permission for any work on their property. So we often hear that, you know, people are just, they're just going to run willy-nilly on the landscape and shoot deer. They don't do that. So,
Mr. Carnicelli?
Yes, sir.
Just a quick question. From time to time, I've heard this from folks, and they wonder, what exactly is a sharpshooter, and how are we determining the qualifications?
Mr. Chair, I wish there was a better term. With USDA, the folks who do the deer removal are they work for USDA Wildlife Services, and this is what they call disease biologists. So they're biologists that are trained, and part of their job is to remove deer either through depredation or urban
biologists
nuisance.
Biologists with guns.
Yes, they are. They're highly trained, highly trained. So we get all sorts of calls about people who want to be a DNR sharpshooter. Well, there are no DNR sharpshooters. We contract that work with folks that have way more training than certainly the general public and even we do. So it's their staff that go through a significant amount of training to get to the point where they can safely discharge firearms.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, and that would start after the landowner shooting permits end.
I have a question quick.
Look.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Cornicelli. Even if there were black helicopters, it's yellow, isn't it?
It's what?
It's a yellow helicopter now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, it is a yellow helicopter, yes. The painting them is expensive. Kind of wrapping it up, funding obviously is an issue. This stuff's expensive. It takes a lot of staff time. It takes a lot of expertise. There's a lot of shipping and diagnostic work involved. And in our perspective, it's more than deer hunting. It's more the deer heritage. If you think about the deer plan that we're going through, you know, we're engaging non-traditional, non-hunting stakeholders in that event. So when we think about white-tailed deer, it's certainly more than deer hunting and the costs that are borne by deer hunters. We're likely going to be doing at least three areas this fall upcoming. We're still going to be dealing with our wild deer response in southeastern Minnesota. And Dr. Anderson will talk about the two newly detected farms, one in Crow Wing County, one in Meeker County. Our standard response is to do surveillance around those farms, much like we did in the southeast initially or anywhere else where we shut the registration off and have people come in with their deer. As Dr. Anderson will talk about, the Crow Wing County trace outs haven't been done yet, so we don't know if there's going to be more areas that we have to do this fall. And put simply, the wild cervid / deer feeding account can't really support this work. I think it has about $900,000 in it, and it just won't support this level of work if we're going to protect the state's wild deer population. As we talk about the Game and Fish Fund, that's not in the greatest shape either, so I think we need to kind of think about a different funding model for handling some of these really important issues that touch everybody, not just that 8 or 10% that hunt deer. So, final slide. You hear a lot about a passive approach. That will result in
second
disease spreading. I'm sorry.
Representative Lewick had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment on that the definition of sharpshooters. Those folks are based out of Grand Rapids, Minnesota. They're part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, APHIS. That's animal plant health inspection folks. One of the least known things that they spend a lot of time every year on is removing problem animals from our airports. So they've got a whole big set of special skills. They're biologists with guns. They're also biologists with traps. It's sharpshooters is just an unfortunate name they picked up, but they do a major service throughout the state of Minnesota for public safety, particularly on our airports.
Sorry for the interruption, Mr.
No, you're fine. I couldn't hear your mic. I apologize. Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick is exactly right. They do the airport removals. They also do the wolf depredation program, so they do a lot of this kind of protection stuff. So we've heard this word passive a lot, our belief and the belief of other folks that manage deer populations across the country that a passive approach will lead to more disease in the future, and that will lead to an endemic disease, and that may lead to impacts in deer populations down the road. It does, you know, as distasteful as it often sounds and what folks kind of make of it, you know, eliminating CWD from southeast Minnesota or anywhere else in the state, it requires aggressive action. I mean, you just don't say, let's see how things will go and maybe it'll be okay. It doesn't work that way. The three deer that we were able to kill during the special hunt are three deer that won't infect other deer down the road. So any positive deer we can get off the landscape immediately benefits us later. It'll remain a health threat to deer locally initially, regionally a little bit later, and maybe statewide down the road. And I think that we've worked a lot with folks, and we need to work together on this. And I think that those short-term reductions in deer densities in order to affect the spread of disease is what's going to be the key to not having to deal with this in perpetuity. I mean, you look at Wisconsin, you know, they're going to have to figure out how to manage a landscape that's going to have a lot of CWD across the state. And that's all I had.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Cornicelli, you know, I'm familiar with that area, and there's often folks that are out snowmobiling, cross-country skiing. In a couple months, they'll be turkey hunting. Is there a mechanism for the DNR if, you know, people are carrying these everywhere, if they see a deer that looks like the deer that was on one of the previous slides, is that helpful? If you don't have the shooters out there, you've got a lot of cameras that can help identify particularly I'm thinking turkey hunting where you may see deer that are emaciated. Do you have a mechanism for taking that, or is that even worthwhile to have those citizens providing you with examples?
Mr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, it's extremely worthwhile, and we do that. We have the CWD hotline set up, and I've heard it ringing enough that people call in with all sorts of stuff. So we're actively picking up deer, vehicle-killed deer. As you all know, there is no shortage of trail cameras in southeastern Minnesota. So I would expect that if someone sees something on a trail camera that doesn't look right, they'll call us, they'll call the conservation officer. Or if someone's turkey hunting and sees a deer that's off, they can't legally kill it because their deer are protected, but they can certainly call the conservation officer or the area wildlife manager who will deal with it. And especially in our we don't test deer statewide. You know, again, it goes back to risk. But in these areas now that we know that we have chronic wasting disease, we are very diligent about following up on those sick deer reports.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see we've got another testifier coming. And I've got a couple of questions. I didn't want this testifier to leave in case he'll answer these. I have a few questions, and they're probably pretty simple for you or your other testifier. Are you going to go into the differences between the bovine disease, the chronic wasting disease? And let me see if I can get this right. Are you going to touch on something called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, I'm sure you maybe know what that is? Were you guys going to discuss those today? And also, where the disease originates? Because from what I've been looking into, it appears that there are groups of animals that have never had contact with pretty much, like in a zoo, for instance, that have never had contact with outside
species that some of these diseases have sprung up.
Representative Green, Dr. Paul will probably go through a number of those things, but we'll let Mr. Quinicelli go ahead and tackle that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I hadn't planned on it, but the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is the human variant. Bovine spongiform encephalopathy is the bovine variant. Scrapie is the sheep variant, and then chronic wasting disease is the ungulate variant. Those all seem to have pretty high species barriers, and they're very specific to that the species they impact. Some of those are spontaneous, like you described, like the human variant is spontaneous. We don't think that chronic wasting disease is spontaneous. It's obviously it started somewhere, but it's transmitted by direct contact among infected animals. So they're all prion diseases, and they all affect the brain similarly, but they're different prions that are specific to the species they impact. But Dr. Anderson may touch on that a little bit more deeply than I will, if that answers your question.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Quinicelli, my question is really along the same line. Are you confident that that is the only vector for the spread of this disease is animal-to-animal contact, or are there other possible vectors for it to be communicated?
Mr.
Quinicelli. Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, it's transmitted by direct contact, so that could mean either animal touching or animal leaving something that another animal picks up. So there's been some work looking at plants and uptake of prions in plants, but a lot of that stuff it's laboratory science, but it's also not relevant to, not relevant is not the right word, but it's not as important when the disease isn't across a broader landscape. So, like in Wisconsin, where 40% of their male population in those counties is positive, then that environmental contamination is much more important than if you have a dead deer here or a dead deer there. So, you know, how it gets started is a subject of debate. It's difficult to tell because there's no strain type. You're either positive or you're not. But we do know that they can pick it up from other infected deer directly. They can pick it up from dead carcasses, the greenery that grows around a dead carcass, or through environmental contamination. But the second two are less important if you're on the front end of an infection.
Representative Purpleson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if you've already covered this. Are there individuals that carry the disease but do not exhibit symptoms?
Mr. Quinicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, there's a long latency period between the time of infection and the time of symptoms. So it may be a year and a half to 3 years before they start showing signs of the disease, and then the decline is fairly rapid. So they're shedding these prions for a long time before they actually exhibit clinical symptoms. And oftentimes, obviously, not every deer lives long enough to die from a disease like this, but fitness is compromised by simply having the disease. So it's more than just I have this someday fatal disease, I'll be fine, because you're predisposing yourself to other things in your life that reduces your lifespan in general because of the disease.
Any closing comments? Otherwise, we'll have Dr. Anderson come down.
No, Mr. Chair, I just appreciate the committee's time. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Appreciate it. Thank you, Dr. Anderson, for coming to the committee, and please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Paul Anderson. I'm an assistant director with the Board of Animal Health. And I'd like to talk to you about chronic wasting disease for a little bit. I think the way to start would maybe be to give you just a little bit of history. The Board of Animal Health has been involved with programs for chronic wasting disease since the mid to late 1990s. And during the late 90s, people who raised farmed deer or elk we kind of shared responsibility. DNR had some of the farms. Board of Animal Health had some of the other farms, and testing for chronic wasting disease was voluntary during those years. Now, certainly, we all became concerned about chronic wasting disease, especially in 2002 when it was discovered in Wisconsin around the Madison area in wild deer. And we Then, oddly enough, in the summer of 2002, we identified our first CWD-infected farm. That farm was in Aiken County. It was an elk farm. And during the traces with that farm, that traced back to a farm in Sauk Center in Stearns County that was determined to be positive as well. And in some of the other traces, there was actually a herd near Green Bay, Wisconsin, that was infected from animals from that same source. Now, certainly when all that was happening, there was a lot of added urgency to make laws for chronic wasting disease and for farm deer and elk. And in the 2003 legislative session, we got our first laws for chronic wasting disease and management of farm deer and elk. And all of the responsibilities for farm deer and elk were transferred to the Board of Animal Health in 2003, and those laws took effect then January of 2004. So since then, we've had a good set of laws for managing and registering farmed deer and elk in the state, and part of that, certainly, and really the crux of the thing, was about chronic wasting disease. And what the laws required from that time was that any farmed deer or elk, farmed deer and elk farms in the state had to be registered with the Board of Animal Health, and they had to test every animal in the farm over 16 months of age that died or was slaughtered for chronic wasting disease. So that was all set up. The farms became registered. A lot of testing was done. And the next farm that was found to be infected was actually in Lac La Parle County near the town of Dawson. That was a white-tailed deer herd. There were no trace outs from that, and that farm was, those animals were euthanized and tested. The next case of chronic wasting disease was in, the Lac La Parle one was in 2006. The next case was in Olmsted County in 2009. That was a very large elk herd that ultimately was also, all the animals were euthanized and tested. The fifth case was in Ramsey County in a red deer herd. One animal tested positive out of 700 animals that were eventually euthanized. All the rest of the animals in that herd were negative. So during these years, certainly we've been working with the Department of Natural Resources folks and coordinating our activities. You know, the goal of the program is to identify infection early if it is there on farms and to control the spread of the disease so we don't move infected animals around. And so that brings us to this fall. And when the wild deer were found to be infected in Fillmore County, right between the towns of Preston and Lanesboro, we have a plan where we draw also a 10-mile circle around these animals, and we actually restrict movement of any of the farmed animals in that 10-mile circle. The reason for that is we certainly don't want to move infected animals out of that area. We want to make sure that they stay there. The way that these folks can continue to operate really is to double fence. What we're worried about is the farmed animals being exposed to the infected animals from the wild. And we actually ended up quarantining or restricting movement on five farms in that 10-mile circle around Preston. And two of those folks have double fenced. One was actually double fenced since 2013. The other three, there is no movement of animals out of those herds allowed. Now, we then most recently identified a CWD-infected farm in Crowing County. Not an expected occurrence. And this herd in Crowing County was doing the surveillance that they're required to do. They slaughtered five animals, and they tested them as they're required to be done. Two of those animals actually turned up to be positive for chronic wasting disease. These were both very young. They're two-year-old does from this farm. So we immediately quarantined the farm and began the investigation to trace where animals may have come from or gone to. And we looked really at a five-year window before this infection occurred. This farm in Crow Wing County is about 130 deer. 30 of these are mule deer, and 100 of them are whitetail deer. So we looked at all the places that the positive animals had been. One was actually born on this farm in Crow Wing County. One was born on a farm in Lac La Parle County, not related to the previous positive, a different farm quite a distance away. And that farm in Lac La Parle County no longer exists because the owner in Crow Wing County bought that small farm, moved all those animals to Crow Wing County. Now, in the trace forwards out of that herd, we've identified four other farms in Minnesota that have received animals from the infected farm in Crow Wing County. One is in St. Louis County near Mountain Iron. One is in Meeker County near Dassel. One is in Stearns County near Freeport. And one is in Crow Wing County, also near Brainerd. Unfortunately, now we know that the farm near Dassel in Meeker County is also infected. That animal that turned up to be positive was one of our trace animals. We were looking forward to see, you know, what the status of those animals was. And this turns out to be a doe, another two-year-old that grew up in the same pen with the other two positives. So not entirely unexpected that we would find another positive. What we're worried about at this point is two of the other trace-forward farms, the one in Itasca County and the one in Crow Wing County, have five animals that also grew up in that same pen. Four on the herd in near Brainerd, and one in the herd in Itasca or in St. Louis County, and so we're really worried about those animals. We're in the process of having them appraised so that we can euthanize them and get them tested. They've not been tested yet, but certainly these herds are under quarantine. The farm in Stearns County has mule deer, two mule deer that came from the farm in Crow Wing County out of a different pen. We're not as worried, but certainly we're concerned about those animals as well. So we're in the middle of this investigation. Unfortunately, we have two farms now that are positive for chronic wasting disease. We've looked, and we can see no connection with this and what's going on in Fillmore County. None of these animals have ever been near or in Fillmore County. Certainly it's coincidental timing-wise that all of this is unfolding at the same time. There are several infected herds that have been found in other states right now as well, and certainly we see no connection between what's going on here in Minnesota and what's going on in other states. But that kind of brings us to the present. So we're dealing with, certainly we're working with DNR in Fillmore County. We want to make sure that the farmers do their part not to move CWD around if it can possibly be avoided. And we're working with our two infected farms, and we yet have some trace-out farms to get tested to determine their status. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Doctor. Representative Metz, I had a question. It got covered, didn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was just going to wonder if they covered the St. Louis County part.
All right. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see. Dr. Anderson, I have a few questions. These diseases have been in the U.K. longer than they've been in the United States, as I understand. I mean, at least they recognized them earlier over there. And so I was reading some of the studies that they've done from there, and I've got a couple questions there. But first I'd like to ask you, does this or has this shown up in predators that eat these animals?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, to my knowledge, chronic wasting disease, the actual prion that causes chronic wasting disease, has never shown up in any animals except for animals of the cervidae family. So that would be deer, elk, moose, reindeer, those types of animals.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that the study that I was reading indicates is that in the cases where these diseases have shown up, there appears to be high manganese. I said it wrong. I'm just having a tongue-tied day. But and low copper. Have you guys done any studies on those?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'm not aware of any connection that's actually been established between manganese and copper levels. Certainly copper and manganese are trace minerals that are important in deer populations, but I'm not aware of actually a definitive connection. There may be someone else who does, but I'm not aware.
Mr. Chair, and I will get the name right. I have pronounced it before. This is one of those days. But like I said, I can only look through this study, and I'm trying to understand this, and I know that we're not going to get to the bottom of it today, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to meet with me and discuss this at a convenient time for you, because I'd like to try to dig into it and understand it a little better.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I would always be glad to meet with anyone, so yes, absolutely.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Anderson, it's been documented that chronic wasting disease does not affect humans. I'm wondering if you could expand on that and tell us a little bit about the research that came to those conclusions and if there's any further research going on.
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm certainly not a prion scientist. You know, I read, you know, the same kind of articles that everybody has. To my knowledge, though, chronic wasting disease and these prions that cause disease like chronic wasting disease, scrapie, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and a very strange disease called Kuru that's found in cannibalistic tribes in New Guinea, they're very species-specific. We don't, you know, it's not our, my understanding anyway, that they cross the species barriers. We, you know, certainly know a lot about prions, but there's a lot yet to learn. When I was in veterinary school, we still called these things slow viruses, so we've come a long ways. But my understanding is that the prion, the misfolded protein that causes chronic wasting disease, is very specific to deer and elk and the family of Cervidae. And I'm not aware that these prions cross over to cause these other diseases. They behave, you know, somewhat differently. Scrapie, for example, in sheep is certainly spread more by placental fluid and birthing fluids than probably any other method. But with chronic wasting disease, we think it's mostly saliva, probably, but certainly urine and fecal material as well. So I think that my understanding from what I've read and what I've studied is that CWD is a very unique prion that's unique to Cervidae. Does that answer the question?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, when the BSC broke out, I think there were restrictions placed on animal protein being put in feed. In other words, not putting other parts or manure or other things in feed. With the Cervidae, is that prohibition there where any feed does not have animal protein added to the feed?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we know that when the BSC thing was happening in England, there was a practice of rendering cattle, doing the rendered product and feeding that back. And we know that proteins can survive that process. I mean, that these prion proteins can survive this process. So we certainly have tried to avoid feeding rendered product back to ruminants. I know that we don't do that for that reason. And with Cervidae, I don't think that that's allowed either, but we certainly don't want rendered product fed back to any of our ruminant animals.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So do we have any prohibition in our feed law, or is it federal?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, again, I'm not an expert on the feed laws, but my understanding is that we do not feed rendered ruminants back to ruminants, and that's federal law.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and you know, again, I go back and look at an outbreak when you have a variety of actions at a very short period of time that are occurring at farms around the country. So, and I think some of the other testifiers or members were asking about vectors. You know, how do things move? Do you have manure on the shoe? Do you have other things where people are moving things? But are we at a point, I want to separate out elk here, but just go right on white-tailed deer, where we have an inherently risky business that now we're our public deer herd is at risk from something that, you know, we've got a track record here over a number of years. And I know they've put in the double fences and that, but this doesn't seem to be going away. So is there something inherently risky here where the risk is too great for this business because of its impact on the public resource?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, that's certainly a very big question. You know, the programs that we have in place for farm deer and elk are much like programs for all livestock. Certainly with these diseases of importance, we want to find them quickly if they're there. We want to make sure that they don't spread, and we want to eliminate the risk of spread either to wildlife or to other farms. So the program is designed that way. Certainly with our two farms that are infected, we have very tight quarantines on these animals. Nothing's allowed to leave the farm. Nothing's allowed to come into the farm, even to slaughter without permit, and we'd want to be involved with all of the steps that would take place there. Carcass disposal is very important, where those carcasses go and how they're handled. So from the farm side, you know, certainly with any disease like tuberculosis, brucellosis, chronic wasting disease, the concern is to identify early, eliminate the possibility of spread, and do that, you know, certainly to the best that we can.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any, like, triage criteria where if we hit a threshold here of so many locations or so many animals within the regulated community where you have authority or ability to do some things if we get to multiple infections? Under existing law, do you have the authority to just say we got to do something else?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, current law certainly does not prohibit farming deer and elk. There are certainly things that people have to do. They have to register with the board. They have to test for chronic wasting disease. There are very good intrastate movement regulations. We don't allow movement of animals unless their CWD testing is up to par. For example, and we do track all of that. We track every animal. We track inventories. We track animals. We track the CWD testing. And if folks aren't doing the CWD testing as required, we restrict movement of animals from those farms. So the law itself would not prevent people from farming deer and elk, but if they do, there's certainly a lot of strings attached to how that's done.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Anderson, let me pull the string a bit further. It kind of sounds like, but correct me if I'm wrong, that the positive surveys appear to have came from essentially one pen and likely from another, the farm over at La Caparra. Is that a fair assessment? In other words, the deer you found that are positive seem to be literally from the same pen?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, it appears at this time that something happened in that pen. We really have ruled out the possibility that it came from Lacaparle County. That herd, the CWD testing there was very good. That farm, all of the animals were moved to the crowing site in July of 2014. This one animal that was moved to Dassel area was moved off of that farm in December of 2014. This farm in Crowing County was a newly formed farm. It was land that was purchased that I don't know exactly the whole history of the land, but I think there was some public ownership of that land. There was a snowmobile trail through that land and a logging trail that then was fenced in. This was the first time that that pen had been used to raise deer. And there may be some other things going on there that we have not got a chance to sort out yet. But certainly it appears that something happened in that pen in that last 7 months of 2014.
Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. Could you give us an idea of just roughly how many deer and elk farms we have in the state of Minnesota and how big that industry is?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the farm survey industry right now, there are about 460 farms that raise deer and elk in Minnesota, and they're really spread almost to every county. There are about 11,000 animals on those farms. Certainly, the majority of those animals are white-tailed deer. We have fairly significant populations also of elk, North American elk. Mule deer are becoming more popular across the country, and so we do have some mule deer. We certainly have a very active reindeer association, and we have reindeer that travel all over the country for Christmas and Thanksgiving and now even this time of year for sleigh rides and that sort of thing. There's a smattering of fallow deer and Sika deer and Pier David deer and some other kinds of deer around the state, but about 11,000 animals altogether, and we could break that down for you if you wish.
Representative Lewitt.
One other quick follow-up. Could you give us kind of a general overview? My understanding is there's kind of two general paths that a farm that's does have chronic wasting disease positive animal that they're going to have to make a decision on which way to go and as to really their entire business and some of the time frames and special requirements to go on with once you have a positive. What's your life expectancy as a business?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, there are really two paths. There's certainly euthanizing the entire herd, and that has happened in our previous five cases where those herds eventually anyway were all euthanized. One of the key components of that has been, at least in the past, whether there's federal indemnity money for those animals. Right now we're working with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to find out if there may or may not be indemnity money for the herds that are infected. We have gotten approval to euthanize the trace out animals, these five animals that we have left. have been approved. They've been appraised. USDA is willing to pay for those animals up to $3,000 per animal, depending on appraisals. We have to get those contracts agreed with ownership before those animals can be killed. But we certainly, our staff would be involved with euthanizing those animals and collecting samples. We don't know about the availability of indemnity money for the two infected herds. We've not gotten approval for that. There are herds across the country that would have asked for that money as well. And there's only so much USDA money available. So, you know, that's yet to be determined. But to answer your question, depopulation is one option. And the other option would be to do some sort of test and removal program, much like we've done with tuberculosis, where the herd is tested. And we do have some live animal tests that can be used. There's a rectal biopsy test that can be done on a live animal. Negative tests don't guarantee negativity, but positive tests guarantee that they're infected. So it's possible that a herd could be tested with a rectal biopsy test, for example, multiple times over a period of at least 5 years, and do some sort of test and removal program to maintain genetics and that sort of thing. We are working with the owner of the Crow Wing County herd to determine kind of where that gentleman would like to go. Things are too new with the Dassel herd to have really had that conversation. So I don't know the answer of which direction this will end up going, but no animals can leave the farm and no animals can come in to the farm while they're under quarantine. And quarantine released by any other method except for depopulation would probably be a 5-year or more process.
Dr. Anderson, the maximum reimbursement, it sounded like, was in the neighborhood of $3,000. Of course, the value of an animal can be significantly more than that. What is a high value that you're familiar with in terms of some of these animals?
I can tell you that there are animals, certainly, that $3,000 would be enough. I know that some of the mule deer in this particular herd that we're talking about, one male mule deer was actually, the owner was offered $275,000 for this animal this year. And I don't know the details. I think maybe a half interest was sold. But this is a herd that a lot of these animals have been bred with embryo transfer and certainly semen. From high genetic animals. Some of these animals can be well into six figures without any problem, is my understanding.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Two different kinds of questions. One, just the implication of your recent testimony is that owners are expecting taxpayers to pay for deer. Or do we not require them to carry insurance as part of their business?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm not aware of insurance for this type of thing, for like chronic wasting disease. I don't know that such insurance exists, but I could be wrong. I'm not sure. And the federal indemnity money that's been available over the years, there's a small pot of money for eliminating chronic wasting disease exposed or infected animals. That's the only indemnity money that I've ever been aware of, and it's part of the National Chronic Wasting Disease Program.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay, thank you. It does seem to me that we ought to understand if this is going to move on to the public to pay for, or do these owners know that they're assuming a risk where there's not going to be public reimbursement? And that's something I would hope the department can help us with later. But on another different question, Is there active research now to see how long these prions last or are viable?
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, two questions there, I think. And the one about how long prions last, that's a very good question. We know that it certainly could be up to 5 years, we think. I mean, there's no kind of definitive endpoint, but we know that there have been farms in Colorado and Wyoming that were known to be infected. They were left fallow for a number of years, up to 5 years, and animals were put back in those pens that were negative, and they did become infected. So we're certainly worried about soil contamination. 5 years is kind of the industry standard. I don't know if that's based in absolute science, but 5 years is certainly the number that's used for example, keeping fences up after farms are depopulated. And to answer the other question, our infected herd in Ramsey County was a very large, very nice red deer herd. And when that farm was determined to be infected in 2011, there was no federal money available. And so basically what we had to do is sit at the kitchen table with this owner and say, your farm is quarantined, you can't move anything in, you can't move anything out, and there's no money to help. And so that was kind of the position that owner was put in originally. We were able to work out a deal where about 350 of those animals were sent under permit to slaughter in Illinois. The carcasses were held till the negative tests were back, and the food was allowed to go into the human food chain. And so there was some salvage value that direction. But the indemnity money did not come available till, I think, 3 years into that quarantine. And then the animals that were left, they did take the money and euthanize those animals. But, yeah, sometimes, and we really don't know the outcome here, whether there'll be any help for these folks or no help at all.
Mr. Chairman, my question was a little different. Could I just try it again?
Representative Aguinius.
Thank you. I wanted to know if there was active research to on the life of the prion. Not, I mean, we're assuming it's 5 years, but if our assumption is bad, that's not good. So, I mean, there is a lot of research that goes on in this state. We pay for a lot of research. It does seem to me that this would be a good place to invest some dollars.
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, there certainly is research going on. One of the problems, my understanding anyway, one of the problems with looking at soil is it's very difficult to test soil for prions. We certainly know how to test animals for prions, but testing the soil is much, much more difficult. A lot of the research that's gone in the past has been putting negative animals back on land that had infected animals on it and seeing what happened. But certainly there are people around the world that are doing research on chronic wasting disease. You know, we've now found chronic waste disease for the first time in Norway and reindeer. And so, you know, that's the first time it's been found anywhere out of the North American continent. And, you know, so certainly there's research going on. These prions are tough to study. They're very difficult to determine everything, how they work. But certainly people are looking at that. We'd love to know those answers definitively.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we heard a little bit about private business cost or private business investment. But, you know, I think we heard earlier, and maybe the DNR could come up to the testifying chair as well, of how much we've spent in public money in this latest outbreak, or perhaps another way of looking at this is a lost deer that when we have
poaching of deer, we have a restitution value if somebody took those deer, the public deer, you know, from the public, they have to do restitution. There's a value to deer. I think that maybe Dr. Cornicelli could give that amount. And then finally, you know, I mentioned about having a fence to keep the public deer from the private business. Another way to look at that is it the responsibility of the private business to keep the private deer from the public deer? Were the infected sites double-fenced?
Who is that question directed at?
The last one was to the Board of Animal Health.
Dr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, the requirement in the law is a single 8-foot fence, you know, a single 96-inch tall fence. The people, for example, in Fillmore County that have double-fenced on their own have done that because we certainly are going to require that if they want to continue to move animals around Minnesota to other spots. We have not ever had an infected farm that has tried to test out of this disease over a period of years. We don't have the authority currently to require double fence, but certainly that would be a discussion that will take place if someone's going to do something other than euthanizing the herd.
Mr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, with respect to costs, I don't know the restitution value of white-tailed deer. I'm not sure of that. But with costs, since 2002, we've spent $10 million between TB and CWD, and I can't remember which one is four and which one is six. So it's somewhere between $4 and $6 million on our CWD response. This response this winter, it typically costs us about $150,000 to $200,000 to do voluntary surveillance. Again, we do that at the level that we can detect disease, so we do a lot of sampling. The response this winter, now that we found the disease, is probably going to be, depending on whether we contract with USDA, $600,000 to $700,000, depending on the level of contracting we have to do. So it's very expensive. But the flip side is the Fish and Wildlife Service survey of hunter and angler expenditures indicates the deer population, just from an economic value, was about $500 million a year. So, you know, our goal with reducing the potential for an endemic disease is that future investment. So it costs us a lot to respond to these things, regardless of what the wildlife health emergency is.
Dr. Anderson, how many farms did you say that you know are here in Minnesota?
The total number of farms, about 460 farms.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I think the challenge here is the weighing the private business versus the public interest, the public cost, private cost, and what's involved. And I'm sure we're going to have requests for public funding for private business here. I'm sure it's coming. And that... what is the public role here, and how much public money do we spend for the public purpose? That, so when we talk cost, you know, we have to look at that whole picture, not only for the individual business and risk, but the public purpose and risk.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was answered.
Any questions? Any follow-up questions? Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're kind of winding down here, but first I'd like to thank the Board of Animal Health and the DNR for the work they've done in the past. They've been, we have work done here in Minnesota, I think, particularly back to the tuberculosis situation we had, where the Board of Animal Health did excellent work, and I have confidence that they will continue to do excellent work in the future. So. We depend on you guys to deal with these sorts of issues. You are the experts, but if you need our help, be sure to let us know. On a lighter note, I have a question for Dr. Anderson. Dr. Anderson, do you have a middle initial?
I do have a middle initial, and it's L, It stands for Leighton, L-E-I-G-H-T-O-N. That's my middle name, and I'm named after a favorite uncle.
Well, the reason I asked Dr. Anderson,
Mr. Turples,
we seem to have an overabundance of Paul Andersons around here, and I'm hoping that you guys can get together and help us keep these separated. I'd hate to have to put up fences to keep you from touching noses or something.
Dr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A number of times a farm in Crow Wing County was referenced. That's 3 miles from my house. And, of course, there's a lot of folks that are concerned. And I just want to thank Dr. Anderson and folks from DNR for being on top of this from day one. I've heard from the farm and from constituents in the area that they see that this isn't something that's slipping between the cracks by any means. This is something that folks are taking very seriously. And I am very grateful for that. And I think it's an example as well of the systems in place to a certain extent working. You have a farm that self-reported. They came with the samples, and they found that there, of course, was some pretty significant issues. And so just thank you for testifying today and for your efforts in Crow Wing County. And if there's any other comments, you may proceed. We're going to adjourn.